Hi, I'm Dave Summers, and welcome to AMA's Edgewise, where you will hear fresh insights from recognized thought leaders across a wide range of subject matters. AMA's Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. The AMA is a global leader in professional development and education, improving the immediate performance and long-term growth of individuals and organizations. Check us out on our website, www.amanet.org. James Kiltz has led three major companies, Gillette, Nabisco, and Kraft, by fundamentally doing what matters most. In his new book, Doing What Matters, a vivid first-person account of his executive experience, Jim reveals his system for success that is both cutting-edge and back to basics. Jim, thanks for being with us here today. Your book is called Doing What Matters, a phrase that you say has been the guiding principle of your management philosophy since early in your career. What exactly does doing what matters mean to you?
Well, the entire book explains what doing what matters means, and it has lots of illustrations and stories that make the concept very easy to understand. In brief, it means identifying and tracking only the important things and ignoring all the rest. I use the example of my first days at Gillette to illustrate how I identified what matters in turning around Gillette and how it had entered what I call the circle of doom. And I explained the circle of doom in the book, but the circle of doom takes on different pictures in different companies. At Gillette, it meant that we had started with unrealistic objectives and that we had overly invested in overhead and in cost to chase those objectives. And then what happens is you wind up missing those objectives. You have sales shortfalls. And then you begin to cut marketing, you take pricing, and then what happens is you ultimately fall short or just make those unrealistic objectives, and that circle starts all over again. So you get deeper and deeper into the circle of doom. And that's what had happened at Gillette.
In your book, you talk about how when you came to Gillette, you were faced with a dizzying amount of options as to how to improve performance. And one of the courses of action you could have taken would have been to sell the Duracell business, the Duracell battery business, which was badly underperforming. You used a system you call the fast-track quick screen elimination process to evaluate each of the options. And tell us how that process works in general, and in particular, how it worked when you were deciding whether or not to divest the Duracell business.
Well, the fast-track quick-screen elimination process works in many different situations, and I've applied it in many different situations. And it was especially valuable in assessing Duracell. Essentially, quick-screen requires that you reduce a problem or an issue to its simplest elements and strip out all the extraneous factors. And I described how we did that in the book. Then you ask fact-based questions that require you to give fact-based answers. These must be simple and clear and enable you to decide whether you need more analysis or if you can just review what you have and screen out the non-starters and also-rans right off the top and be confident at the end that you've identified the best option. At Duracell, what we had done was made a number of strategic and executional mistakes. And we had taken a business that was arguably one of the best performing consumer product companies of the past two decades, and we had made it a problem child. And what we did during this quick screen process was we focused on the essentials, the market position, the brand equity, growth prospects, cost elimination potential, and we reached the conclusion that Duracell was a keeper, and it ultimately became a key part of our turnaround at Gillette.
One of your biggest challenges was instilling a cost-cutting discipline that had long been absent from Gillette's corporate culture. You didn't want the company to just grudgingly accept the need for cost-cutting. You wanted them to enthusiastically embrace it. Well, how do you get your managers excited about cost-cutting? I mean, it's usually something that managers dread.
You're right. It's usually something managers dread. But I'm a big believer in the importance of communications, and it's important for CEOs. But it's also important regardless of your level in a company or an organization. And I talk about that in the book. You must make people understand what you want to do and why you want to do it. If you gain their understanding and support, great results are possible. And we certainly got great results at Gillette. And that's what you must do in creating a cost-cutting culture. People must know that the primary purpose of eliminating unnecessary cost is to improve products, market them better, increase sales, and in general, make the company healthier. We created a short word, ZOG, and another one, NOG, zero overhead growth and negative overhead growth, which became badges of honor at our company. And I can't tell you how many times that young managers came up to me and said, we're really working hard on zogging or nogging. And they were proud of what they were doing in eliminating unnecessary costs, because what we did was describe to employees how we took those costs that were eliminated and put them back into building the business. And that really created the performance culture that we wound up with at Gillette.
So it's about making them understand how what they're doing relates to a larger, higher vision.
It's all about building the business and building our brands and building the organization. And how you do that is you need to take out those unnecessary costs and invest them back in brand building activities.
You say that knowing when to stop analyzing and when to act has been one of the keys to your success. As a guide to knowing when to act, there are four principles in particular that you rely on. Can you share with us those principles?
Well, action must always be a top priority, because one of the biggest issues in all organizations is the proclivity for inaction. I identify four times when it's imperative to act in the book. First, to overcome a state of ongoing protracted analysis. Good illustration is at Gillette, we had about 21,000 different product varieties. We called them stock keeping units. And for a company of our size, that was just excessive. And when I asked the group about what we were doing about the 21,000, my senior staff, what we were doing about the 21,000 stock keeping units, my key logistics person raised his hand and said, I'm leading a team that's addressing this issue. We have an interdisciplinary task force that's working on it. In fact, we've been working on it over a year. We have an outside consultant that's helping us, and we feel we're making great progress. I said, well, that's terrific. This was, you know, 3 months after I started with the company. So, well, that's terrific. In the year and a half that we've been working on this, how many stock keeping units have we taken out of the system? You could have heard silence in the room, and I sipped my coffee. Still silence. And finally, somebody spoke up and said, well, we haven't taken any out yet. So, and there were all kinds of reasons I asked why. And I gave them the option of bringing in the stack of a computer printout that had the 21,000 items listed on it and bringing me a red magic marker so we can get started this afternoon. That afternoon, when I talked about taking the red magic marker, that was throughout the company, and we made tremendous progress after that. And in fact, we got it down in a short order to 7,000 SKUs. The second reason, or the second illustration that I use in the book, is to break through inertia. and a good example there was the Nabisco sales force. We had when I took over at Nabisco, the sales force had been reconfigured. And historically, it was a sales force that was known for being one of the powerhouses in all of consumer products. And everybody in the organization knew that this reorganization that had just been completed was not working in the marketplace. But nobody wanted to take action and recognize publicly that it wasn't working. So deep down, everybody knew. When you ask even the lowest levels of the organization, they knew it wasn't working. And in this case, what we had to do was that we used the quick screen methodology, but what we came up with was an action plan that really reinvigorated the Nabisco sales force. So to break through inertia and the lack of action in an organization is the second principle I talk about in the book. And third, it's to secure a first-to-market advantage. I use an illustration in the book about DiGiorno Rising Crust Pizza. And here we didn't have as much consumer information as we needed or would like to have to normally make a decision to take the product and go into national distribution. But we saw that we had a superior technology. We knew competition was going to be on our tail. And again, we took action and broke through and made a significant difference with a huge product success in DiGiorno. And the fourth was the fourth example I use, a principle in the book, was to invest in brand building equities. What we did in many cases in the companies that I've been associated with, one of the key challenges coming into these turnaround situations was that great brands had been starved for advertising, promotion support, and really for innovative ideas. So what we did was began to invest in brand building, both at Nabisco and at Gillette, and those things significantly turned around the trends that were in the business, and we went from negative trends to very strong positive trends and created a lot of value and a lot of equity for our brands over that period of time.
Okay, on the topic of evaluating performance, you say you like the 1 to 100 grading system. Why do you like this system?
Well, I think I love that system because people can understand it. You know, they've brought up at in a school system that uses that system, the grading system. And what I really like about it is that it forces feedback. I use that as part of my quarterly evaluation. So everybody gets a grade every quarter. You get to talk about what things you wanted to accomplish. We call those our quarterly priorities. We set those every quarter. There's usually about 10 for every one of my key managers, and it's my direct executive staff that I use them with, and then it cascades down the organization. But what it does is it provides feedback every quarter. It provides the ability to agree on what needs to be done, and then a progress report against doing it. What I like about it especially is I give myself a grade with the board of directors every quarter on how well we've accomplished our goals for that quarter. So it's a conversation that you can have at the very top of the company that cascades all the way down to the bottom of the company, and it results in a numerical grade and discussion of the reasons for that grade. So it's a great communication tool. That's what seems to work in an organization, and people embrace it because it is simple and they can understand it.
Jim, you're obviously a strong believer in the value of rigorous, well-established processes. Why is process such an important element of being a successful manager?
Well, I mentioned the importance of communications. Process is part of the overall communications infrastructure. We talked about that in the grading system. People want to do the right thing, and I found that over and over in my career. I have a very positive view of what people want to accomplish. All too often, however, they don't know why they come to work every day. And we found that in surveys, and if you talk to management experts on problems in organizations, it's people either don't understand what their job description is or don't feel like they have the tools to get their job done. And the process, that process of creating annual objectives, quarterly priorities, and grading those, helps people understand what must be done and how it must be done, because part of setting those objectives is talking about those things you're going to do to accomplish those objectives and how all the pieces come together. And what I like to do is talk to the whole organization. Without process, team accomplishments just aren't possible because you can't link up and cross-fertilize and make sure that everybody's on the page, same page, trying to accomplish the company's objectives. So we spend a lot of time in doing what matters, describing the concepts, as well as some of the nuts and bolts of the process we use.
And finally, you emphasize setting the right tone on the first day on the job as a CEO. Do you think that applies to everyone at every level in the organization, or should middle managers implement change more gradually so as not to alienate people?
Well, I don't think you'll alienate your people if you are straightforward and tell them, first of all, your own management philosophy, how you like to work, your habits, your beliefs about how you manage, and then what you expect of them. So I think it's part, again, of the communication process. And the best thing a manager can do is take out uncertainty out of an organization. And it's true for CEOs, and it's true for new managers that people are apprehensive. They don't know what to expect. The more you can tell them the first day about what to expect, what your philosophy is, what you expect from them, how you run a management process, how you'll give them feedback, how they'll know how well they're doing, the better off you are, because it creates that communication and that alignment that's so important in achieving results.
The book is called Doing What Matters. The author is Jim Kiltz. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
It's been great to be here.
It's once again time for You've Been Spotted, where we interview random people who are attending a workshop or seminar at one of our five executive conference centers. For more information on our executive conference centers and seminars, please visit our website, www.amanet.org. And here's Kevin Lee.
Today at the AMA Center, I asked participants of AMA's seminar, Leadership Skills for New Supervisors, about how they keep their staff and themselves focused on doing what matters.
Well, I mean, just one tool I've kind of been using, and I think I'm going to, based on what I've learned in the seminar, I'm going to tweak a little bit, is every Friday I have a staff of five, and every Friday we have just real quick 15-minute meetings, because you don't want to have weekly meetings that go on forever. But we look at everything they're working on, and I help them to prioritize where those should be. And my hope before was, I think I was doing a little bit too much for them. My hope was that they would learn over time, like kind of what I thought the priorities were. But what I've learned in the seminar actually is that it would be best to kind of help to ask them to prioritize for themselves and why, and work through it, and then they're able to, in the end, better prioritize for themselves, and you're not doing it for them anymore.
I manage a small team of creative people inside of a marketing department, so obviously keeping people on task in a creative sense is extremely important, because creative people just want to get way out there and do their own thing, and you need to clearly know how to rein them back in. So one of the really important concepts that I think that I learned here, or maybe more reinforced on a fundamental level, was in instilling trust and having employees trust you and trusting them, and as long as you're communicating with them and you're open and you're honest, I think that was really something that kind of came through to me, like constantly be honest with myself too about what I'm asking them to do.
Hi, my name is Laura Smith-Denaeff, and I am one of the course leaders for Leadership Skills for Supervisors. People were really looking for a definition of what makes the difference between someone who's a good supervisor or a good manager, meaning very task-oriented, and what really translates into what makes a leader, someone that people look up to, someone that people trust and are willing to rally around in terms of motivation for the company and for the team. Probably the most light bulbs that I saw go on in the room were related to talking about the continuous performance assessment process and how doing an annual performance review isn't the one opportunity that you have in order to motivate someone. And in fact, because often it's the only time that people provide employees with any kind of formal feedback, that it isn't a very good motivational tool. And they were able to see that through implementing a continuous feedback process and coaching sessions that were more of a discussion and a dialogue and much more collaborative than, hi, you're, you know, in trouble because you did what, changes the dynamic of a team, and it changes the relationship you have with the employee and is much more impactful in terms of developing the employee.
Remember, we'd really like your feedback, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.